Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm in the studio with Brendan Klinkenberg and Brittany Spanos. We're going to be talking about the life and music of Mac Miller, who died at the age of 26, which is an awful thing. He was really talented, and we thought we'd devote an episode to him. Brittany's going to be talking later about a ridiculous thing that happened in relation to this death, which was an apparent overdose, which is that people online were somehow blaming Mac's ex, Ariana Grande, for this, and that's part of a long-standing trend in people's thinking, which is fairly disgusting and ridiculous, and we'll get to that. Brendan, Mac was a really interesting case because his debut album, Blue Slide Park, which came out all the way back in 2011, he was super young, wasn't good. It wasn't great. I don't think it's that bad personally, but it certainly wasn't great. It certainly was not a masterpiece. Rolling Stone gave it, I think, 2.5 stars, but Pitchfork gave it a rare 1 out of 10 ranking, which, as you were saying earlier, is a little bit of a stunt ranking. But that's something that, when you get slammed that hard with your debut, it's something that tars an artist, and that he reacted pretty strongly to all the negativity and turned it around in a way that's really amazing and unique. Could you take us through that a little bit?
So Mac was, he read the reviews. That's like kind of one of the things that defined his career. He was very interested in what critics thought of him. He was interested in improving his music. A lot of the reactions to his first album, which like capped off a series of mixtapes that he made when he was in high school, was really a reaction to the scene that people thought Mac Miller was part of, which was burgeoning at the time. A lot of people called it frat rap. So it was kind of the stuff that you heard from Asher Roth and this guy like Sammy Adams and all these like very like vaguely problematic white dudes making hip hop that like college kids were supposed to party to. And Max was obviously a very carefree white dude rapping, but he was always a little better, but his album kind of sold better, got more attention, and he was seen as the poster child for this stuff. He always had like a facility with rapping that was a little better and a more of an in-depth appreciation for hip hop and like old artists.
Well, let's hear from his debut, Party on Fifth Avenue, just to get a sense of where he started from. So where my kids at, these motherfuckers hating, sounding funnier than Sinbad. I'm ill as the pills that they give you when you can laugh. This, that, the other, kiss your mother with that mouth. We the assholes that she wants. So even on the first album, there's a little sign of him knowing the history. There's an interpolation of It Takes Two, you know, which he didn't sample. He kind of replayed, it seems like, yeah.
Yeah, and people at the time got kind of mad about that kind of stuff. But in retrospect, it kind of shows an artist who, like, Mac, even from the beginning of his career, was, like, very into telling people that his favorite rapper was Big L. He had this knowledge and appreciation for old school rap that none of his peers had, and kind of would blossom into this facility with rapping that most people didn't see the potential for when he was first coming out.
And, you know, even some of our listeners might not be familiar with Big L. And Big L was a rapper from Harlem who was tragically cut down at the very beginning of his career. But in the 90s, before his death, you know, he was up there with Jay-Z. Mm-hmm. It was a serious discussion over who was better, Jay-Z or Big L. And I did see an interview with Mac, and we'll be playing some of my interview with Mac in a little bit. But I did see an interview where he was, you know, he really prided himself on having discovered Big L and having that distinction of an influence that other people his age certainly wouldn't be aware of.
Yeah, and like the people that he was being grouped in with were not talking about Big L. He was sampling like Lord Finesse and these people that, if you're going to try and look at him as this white kid from Pittsburgh who doesn't really know what he's doing, like he didn't really fit in that box from the very beginning. And then you kind of see that develop. He takes the critical reception to Blue Slide Park pretty hard and immediately starts to figure out what's next, and it leads to a lot of artistic development.
Let's hear Big L's Ebonics for a second just to get a sense of him. When I'm lifted, I'm high. When new clothes on, I'm fly. Cars is whips and sneakers is kicks. Money is chips, movies is flips. Also cribs is homes, jacks is pay phones, cocaine is nose. I just wanted an excuse to play Big L. But yeah, so then Mac's second album was a real breakthrough.
Yeah, so in between his major labels, his next one would be called Watching Movies with the Sound Off, and then in between Blue Slide Park and that, he had a mixtape called Macadelic, and they both kind of see him start to abandon that party rap sound that he was like courting for the whole first album. He moves to LA. He starts working with these beat scene producers. He has a couple songs with Flying Lotus, who kind of is a juggernaut in the LA experimental rap scene. He starts working with a lot of rappers like Vince Staples and Earl Sweatshirt, who are these, at the time, like super young and way smaller than him, but he sees their like rapping potential, and they're both huge names now, kind of.
Yeah, Vince Staples said basically there would be no Vince Staples music without Mac, which is a huge statement.
Yeah, so Mac's album netted him a lot of money, and he immediately started to kind of spread that wealth. He had the first independent number one album in, I think, 16 years with Blue Side Park, so it was critically reviled, but commercially insanely successful. So he moves to LA, builds a studio in his house, and then starts inviting just artists he thinks are interesting, and like produces a full album for Vince Staples.
And it should be mentioned that, you know, Mac, one of the things that was really cool and interesting about him, he was a musician. You know, of course you're a musician if you're a rapper, but he played a bunch of instruments, and a producer. He played piano, he played a ton of stuff, and was, you know, jamming at a level where he would jam with, you know, like Thundercat and stuff. Mm-hmm. What's your Watching Movies, the song from his second album? Get mind fucked with these broads. Life's just a recital. Better remember all that you practice. When I die, throw a couple bad bitches in my casket. Whoa, think it's time for a revolution. Me and my dogs about to start a riot. The posturing got less and less as the albums go on, I would say.
Yeah.
There's still a little bit of that here. But yeah, so right, you can produce the whole album for Vince Staples.
Yeah, and like you can, even hearing on that, like it's not so far removed from Blue Side Park, but it's a lot like muddier and murkier. It's playing with a lot of darker tones, but also the themes are getting a lot darker. This is the start of him rapping about his own death kind of a lot. That's a running theme, and it's not in the self-mythologizing way like Tupac did. It was like an actual, he thought about his own death very often, like what it would do to the people around him and like what would cause it.
And, you know, through all of this, he was developing a substance abuse problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is about the time that he was very public, and he would talk about this like in very frank terms all the time. But he developed a substance abuse problem with lean, which is, you know, a very popular drug for rappers. He would go through periods of sobriety and relapses all the way through up until the end of his life. It was a big part of both his music and his personal life, and something that he like struggled with, but also thought about, it seems like, pretty clearly.
Yeah, and when I spoke to him, he seemed pretty solid in his sobriety, but also acknowledged it's a struggle, which is always the case. It got to the point, we were talking about this before we went on air, you know, everyone's pointing to a tweet that Jay-Z tweeted, where he was talking about all his favorite rappers, and Mac Miller was the one sort of white rapper that he gave a little love to.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. And then there's a picture.
Yeah, Mac framed it.
Mac printed it out, you know, giant size, and literally framed it on his wall, and who could blame him?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think, one of the things that was really important to him was respect from his peers. And then, obviously, if you get a shout out from Jay-Z, this was after Jay-Z was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He was kind of thanking a lot of the people that he saw as paving the way, and then kind of trying to anoint. It was very stream of consciousness. He was like talking about like how black rappers are great. And then he was like, but some white guys too. Shout out to Mac. And yeah, that must have meant the world to him.
And again, we were kind of building up to it, but how did it get to the point where, you know, if Jay-Z, of all people, was sort of thinking one white rapper popped to his mind and it's Mac Miller, what were the things that kind of built Mac Miller in the estimation of the culture that would get there?
I think it's kind of what he always wanted to be better. So every album you saw improvement, he was, to start, you could argue about the substance of what he was rapping about in that early stage of his career, because it's like very carefree music. But he was always preternaturally talented as a lyricist. Like, he was always had a turn of phrase. He was always able to write a beat in a very clever way. And then as soon as he starts to dive into more thematically and musically ambitious stuff, he's suddenly up there with like the other great people that are working. Every project that he released, with a couple exceptions, usually got better than the last. And that's the kind of thing. He died very young, but his career was actually about 10 years long.
Yeah,
so
wow.
When you have that kind of consistent improvement, and more people take notice every time you put an album out, at the end of a 10-year process, even if you started at like a Pitchfork 1.0, people are going to really respect you. And Mac is kind of one of those people who just committed to getting better, and that's a big part of why people respected him so much.
And like I was saying, there was some posturing, especially on the first album, but at the same time, he was true to who he was. He was Jewish. He was bar mitzvahed, and there's references to that mm-hmm. from the very first album. Flat, he says something to the effect of, like, I think of my people who died in the Holocaust, and it just makes me glad to be alive and stuff like that. And that's an unusual sentiment for hip hop, and I appreciated the sort of, you know, the realness of that.
Yeah, and I think it's also one of those things. Max started rapping when he was about 14 and was putting out mixtapes that people were listening to by 16. And I've been listening to a lot of Mac in the past week for our coverage, and overwhelmingly I'm just kind of like, I'm glad what I was writing about and working on at 16 was not put out there. He matured a lot, and he just, a big part of that was he had to mature publicly.
So when I spoke to him, it was 2016, and it was for his album The Divine Feminine, and by that point he was dating Ariana Grande. Brittany, maybe you want to jump in here. What was the perception of them as a sort of celebrity couple when they started dating?
Well, their career, at least Mac, had always been linked with Ariana's career. He was featured on one of her first big singles, The Way. And so they had known each other for about 5 years, I think. Yeah, they had known each other since he was around 21. So they had worked together a lot, and then they started dating, and they dated for 2 years. Fans always knew that Mac Miller was a big part of Ariana's life. I think people were kind of expecting that they would date. The Way was like, people started to believe that they were going to start dating then, but they didn't. So it was always kind of expected, I think, at least for their fan bases.
There was a really funny thing, which is a while ago after their breakup, Ariana was responding to the idea that it was an album about her, and she said, no, it wasn't an album about me, just this song, Cinderella. And this song, Cinderella, is the raunchiest sex song I've ever heard in my entire life. I mean, it's like practically pornographic, and it was fairly hilarious, at least to me, that she felt the need to be like, no, just that song. That's like, you know, if you listen to it, you'll know it's just TMI. If you want to know TMI about me, just listen to that one song. But let's hear The Way, if we can. So fine, make you feel so fine. I hope you hit me on my celly when I sneak in your mind. You a princess to the public, but a freak when it's time. Said you better be feeling lonely, so you sleeping in mine. Come and watch me. So there's also a duet called My Favorite Part on The Divine Feminine. I really love that song. And as I told Mac, I first heard it just came up on some playlist, and I had no idea what it was. Like, I didn't know it was him. I didn't even know if it was an old song or a new song. And I was just like, this is some really soulful shit. And he was, that really pleased him. He really liked that. But let's hear that song. I know you fall too small. Before things come together, they have to fall apart. It's been a while since I've been sober. This life can be so hard. So in my interview, which again was in 2016, he was actually in a shopping mall in South Africa when he called, because a tour stop there, and he was like picking up a jersey from like the local soccer team so that he'd get, you know, to kind of make the crowd happy that night. And you could kind of hear him in the middle, like just stopping to say hello to random people in the South African mall. And it was a totally very chill conversation. But let's hear what he had to say about how that particular duet came together.
Well, I just wanted it to be something really simple as far as instrumentally. I put that hook together like pretty instantly, and then I stayed up the whole entire night going back and forth whether I was going to sing or rap on it. And then, like, I couldn't decide, and then I just went to sleep, and I was like, I give up, and woke up and decided to just sing. There was possibly a little courage from John Jameson involved, but just like, I don't know, just I just went for it, and then like I hit Ariana up to get on the record, and we went over to a studio and worked on her part.
Personal shit aside, I mean, she has chops for days. Did you have any insecurity about like, oh shit, I'm gonna have like someone who's compared to Mariah Carey singing next to me? I'm gonna sound ridiculous. Hey, you know what I mean? Was that in your head at all?
You know what? It really wasn't, because it's like, I'm not trying to do that.
Right. You
know? Like, I think, like, that's what she, when she comes in, she's supposed to sound like angelic, and she's supposed to sound like, wow, this is amazing. You know, like, me, I'm just capturing an emotion, and then, like, our voices together sound like, sound how they sound. So it's like, you know, like I'm not trying to compete with her singing in any, at any day. Never. You know what I mean? But like, I have my emotion that I'm putting into that record, and it's one that I can't do unless I sing like that.
How aware were you the possibility of, you know, make a record like this is always a danger of becoming too soft or too sappy, given its theme and subject matter and everything? Like, how aware were you of that challenge, and how did you try to avoid it?
Man, I don't think about that shit, man. It's like, I've had every kind of perception about me you can think of.
Uh-huh.
So, like, all I'm thinking about when I'm making music is the music that I'm making. Like, you know, I'm not worried about how it's going to be perceived. I'm not worried about if people are going to think that I have no business doing this, or that if I come back and rap that now I've already sang. So it's like, man, fuck all that. Like, I'm just creating different planets. So, like, you know, people can enjoy them, come to them, like, or not. It's not, I don't know, getting tied up into the whole, like, what the perception of Mac Miller means to the music I'm making is counterproductive. You know, I'm just, like, creating.
We're talking about the life and music of Mac Miller, and we're playing a little bit of audio from my 2016 interview with Mac Miller. We were talking about his album, The Divine Feminine, which was a real breakthrough for him. There's stuff on it, as we played a song called My Favorite Part, that with Ariana Grande, his then girlfriend, that really isn't hip-hop at all. There's a lot of his live instrument playing on there. There's a lot of him singing, which was a new thing, you know, and he actually had a really cool, soulful voice. So it's a little bit in that, like, Everlast vein. Like it's funny how some people, there's certain veins that people who rap sometimes fall in when they sing, and that's slightly that. But he definitely had legit talent as a singer. But in general, right, it really was a step forward. I think Universal acknowledges that.
Yeah, so if you kind of look at Mac's career, he obviously starts as this kind of like high school rapper who starts to rap for college kids, and it's all partying, and then Blue Side Park comes out, and he enters like a second act of his career where he's working with like interesting producers, trying to make almost like this backpack rap for like the LA avant-garde scene, working with a ton of young rappers. And then with 2016 coming around, he enters like a whole new phase where he's working with live instrumentalists like Thundercat. You were mentioning earlier that he was himself like a talented musician, and that starts to really come through. And then The Divine Feminine is this album that has a lot of breathing room in a way that like a lot of rap albums don't. He starts singing a lot. He's like very, very comfortable with like a song not really doing too much. It's like a very calm, happy, vibey album.
And some of it actually is, I think, it's sobriety as much as anything. It's being in love, sober, all that stuff was kind of coming together. Although, like we said, there was a sort of denial that it really was as a whole about Ariana. But you can feel it. It's mellow. And he was in a mellow place when I spoke to him, clearly. And, you know, he's, as we heard in the interview clip we just played, you know, he was talking about, like, making little planets with his music. There was something, you know, there was a hippie side to him, you know, for
yeah,
sure.
I think that, like, when I listen back to that album, it just sounds, it's hard to say what accounts for this, and I'm sure a lot of things in his personal life got him to this place, but it sounds really confident. Like, it's not the album that anyone expected him to make, and it was, I think, a real stride forward for him as an artist. He was suddenly, like, trying new things. He was writing songs that weren't rap songs, and I thought it was, like, a real decisive move from someone who'd already had to, like, reinvent himself once, where he'd had to work really hard for his reputation as a rapper and, like, get the respect of people like Jay-Z. And then he's like, you know what I'm going to do next? I'm going to start singing about love.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a traditionally good voice, but I think he has a very open voice. I think it's one of those things where you can kind of hear him straining to hit the notes, and it just makes it feel a little more personal. And I think that album, like, really worked for him. It kind of shifted him to a new gear.
He liked a lot of different music. He talked about his dad played him a lot of Bob Dylan. In fact, his dad apparently would actually pick up a guitar and sing him Bob Dylan. It was that kind of thing. He liked Radiohead. He told me that the first hip-hop album he ever heard was by Outkast, and he was immediately kind of just like hypnotized by it and drawn into it, and was immediately trying to rap along. But I did ask him about singing, about the transition to singing. And it actually starts out, my bad, it starts out with, I asked him about Rick Rubin, who had become like, he wasn't producing him, but he was a spiritual mentor to him, and which is a, you know, probably if you know Rick Rubin, probably a couple albums down the line, maybe Rick would have become his producer. But he was hanging out, he was playing music for him, and I asked him what Rick Rubin meant to him and what he learned from him, and then we talk a little bit about his singing, so we'll hear that.
It was a lot of life lessons. I think, like, the biggest life lesson I learned was just, like, being still. Like, the how important it is to just to quiet your mind a little bit and just being honest with yourself and just to slow down. Yeah, like, also from Rick, like, I also gained a lot of confidence because I remember I played him this music I was working on. It was, like, some weird other shit that never came out. And I played it, and he was like, I've never heard anything like this.
Huh,
and I was so geeked about that. That was... Yeah, there's so many albums. It was one of the albums I was working on. That and being patient. You know what I mean? Patience. But it gave me, like, to be able to play him something and him to be excited about it was really awesome.
You mentioned that when people compliment your singing, you blush. That was a while ago because you were kind of insecure about your singing. I mean, and you sing a ton on this record, comparatively speaking. I mean, what has the process been like of becoming maybe more comfortable with singing and being melodic and finding your voice as a singer?
I think, you know, just knowing that it's my voice, you know, and that's what makes it unique, and that I'm not going to be, you know, this completely classically trained, spot-on singer who has this ridiculous vocal range. Like, I'm going to have my own voice. And I think it's just, like, a journey of getting more and more comfortable with that. Because it feels like being naked a little bit. Like, you mean you're just, like, kind of out there, and it's just kind of becoming more and more comfortable with the fact that my voice is mine, and, like, not, like, I'm not going to sound like Justin Timberlake. It's not going to happen. And that's okay, because I'm going to sound like, and that's kind of, like, just been a process of doing that and just going for it and failing. You know, trying something out and it's sounding horrible sometimes. That's fine.
Singers are sort of non-singers who do sing, like Drake or whatever, who helped you be comfortable with, like, being out there as, like, the kind of singer you are, which is, like, an imperfect singer with a kind of a cool character. Like who helped you kind of get used to that idea?
There's no person that I've really listened to that has been, like, if he can do it, I can do it type thing.
Yeah.
You know? It's really just, like, letting it happen, you know? I mean, like, having random people say that I have a nice voice is wild to me. But I think the more also, like, singing live also is a big help. It's just because then you do it, and that's kind of the most you're, like, out in the open that you could be. You know, there's no, like, sitting there and putting, like, reverb on it to make it sound right. It kind of is what it is.
Right.
So it's just repetition and practice. And, like, the more I sing, the more comfortable I am with it. And the more I hear myself singing on a record, the more comfortable, like, the more I get used to my own voice, you know? And I stop, you know, I just stop worrying about what is quote unquote good, you know, and bad. It's just like, more just what I do.
You know, Brendan Mack was mentioning that there's all these albums. Even at the time, I was aware of, like, some jazz album he had. And so there's like, a bunch of stuff probably that's in his vault, right, that he was working on.
Presumably. He talked a lot. He had big plans. He'd worked on a lot of stuff with a lot of people that never came out. I don't know if it will or it's a thing that he wanted to put out, but it was definitely... He was trying a lot of stuff, and I think that's, like, very important to understand, like, when you look at this artistic development, like, Divine Feminine didn't just, like, pop into his head. He was meeting new people, finding new collaborators, talking to people like Rick Rubin, and started to rethink, like, what he wanted his sound to be and, like, what kind of music he wanted to be putting out.
You said there might be an album with Post Malone?
There was talk about it. He was definitely in the studio with Post Malone, and they had definitely talked about doing an album. When Post tweeted his, like, condolences and regrets after hearing the news, he, like, mentioned that their album will come out someday, but you know, it was probably in the very early stages. Mac had just finished his own album. I think he was just starting to get back in the studio with, like, figuring out what was next.
And as I said, there were all these jams with Thundercat, like, hours and hours. Like, he was actually, you know, he would jam instrumentally, so that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, so I think you can hear it in the sound. Like, I think that, like, when we say that it's, like, an improvisational album, it's a warm-toned album. I was obviously not in the studio with them, but from, like, everyone that I've heard from, it's a thing where they were kind of just hanging out of the studio, trying a bunch of stuff, play for a couple hours, and then you edit it into, like, what he wanted the next thing to be. And, like, his Divine Feminine is kind of the start of his albums sounding like they were recorded live.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that became very clear upon his death was how sort of personally beloved he was. From, you know, there were a bunch of journalists who were actually really tight with him. There were a lot of musicians who considered him a close friend, you know, and that goes, you know, and it goes up and down the spectrum in all sorts of various genres. And the thing is, he was, you know, I was listening back and reading back my interview. We posted more of it last week. He was a really sweet guy. I mean, there were things I was challenging him gently on a few things. For instance, the fact that he had CeeLo on his album. A lot of people pointed to, you know, God, you have a guy who's accused of nasty sexual crimes on an album celebrating the Divine Feminine, not too cool. And he was just like really apologetic, like just sort of like couldn't even, like just was, I wasn't even aware, you know, like, and then, you know, even on a milder note, which is my favorite part, the lyrics are very similar to, thematically, to One Direction's That's What Makes You Beautiful, which he said he'd never heard or heard of in his life. But I said, you know, listen, like that song got a bunch of criticism for saying that's such a cliched trope, like, oh, you don't know you're beautiful, that makes you even more beautiful, it's so good. And it's like, why can't you know what you look like? Like, why is that, why are you making that a thing? And he just was sort of horrified. He'd never heard that critique before or even considered. He literally was like, oh man, if I did something wrong, like I apologize instantly, which is not the usual reaction you get from an artist. You usually either get defensiveness or just pleading ignorance. So I thought that was sort of hilarious and says something. I mean, literally, I can't remember ever bringing up a criticism to an artist where they just instantly kind of pleaded guilty and apologized, having never heard it before. And I think that says something about his personality, you know?
Yeah, I think the biggest and longest running case of that was the fact that he was a white rapper working in like a black space. And he's obviously not the first. He's not going to be the last. A lot of people who have that kind of trajectory are very unapologetic and like refuse to really like reckon with it. Like there's a lot of, well, what do you want me to do about it? I wanted to rap, therefore I rapped. And Mac from the beginning and like throughout his career would challenge that. He knew that he was kind of encroaching on something and he wanted to do it as respectfully as possible. He challenged his fans a lot. I think he was constantly having a conversation with himself about like who was listening to him and like how could he make the world a little better, because he did have a through line to like a largely white audience. Like the reason he was popular was not necessarily because he was white, but that's definitely a thing that he was tapping into unintentionally, or on his record label's part probably a little intentionally. And I think that's the kind of person he was. He was willing to like think about different difficult things. He was willing to apologize. He was willing to take a step back. And like, you know, it's of a piece with his artistic development. He always thought about like how to become a little bit better than he was the day before.
Yeah, he did even like a long conversation with Vince Staples, his friend, about, you know, sort of being a white rapper in the space of white rappers. And I asked him whether, like Macklemore, if he ever literally questioned his right to be doing it. And he said no. And certainly not in a song. He certainly never repeatedly wrote songs in which he claimed to write to question his right to do it, which was more the Macklemore move. But you know, he did. He had a very thoughtful answer. You know, he was thoughtful. He was thinking about this stuff all the time. You know, he was, you know, Post Malone. The first time he was asked about sort of race and rap, he acted like it was the first time he'd ever thought about it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He never even considered the question. Well, I mean, we're talking about two extremes here. I don't know if that's really fair to make the comparison.
And if you know Vince, if you've ever met him or like read an interview with him, he's not like, if you haven't thought about this stuff, he's not the guy you want to like jump into an interview with.
You don't want to have an hour long conversation with him having never thought about that issue before. You're going to get destroyed.
But I think Mac kind of gravitated towards the writers, thinkers, artists that like were thinking really hard about this stuff, and he was like, let's talk about it a little bit. Like he knew that there was a lot to learn.
And I also asked him about his sobriety. which is always a tough thing to talk about because you're always aware that it's a work in progress by definition. And without being exploitative, let's hear what he had to say about that.
The planet has a certain gravity, man. It rises in the morning, it sets at night. I never really followed that ever, but now I do. You know, I go to sleep at night and wake up in the day.
Right.
And that's been a beautiful balance in my life.
Did you used to stay up all night recording, and now you work more normal out?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a lot more of a life.
So. Yeah, that's good. Life is good. Is it a challenge still?
Life is good.
Is it a challenge still? It's always a challenge for most people.
Yeah, it's just like a different way of life for me. Like sometimes it's a challenge, but for the most part, it's a blessing.
Has it changed the way you create?
Honestly, I feel like everything. I capture a lot more real emotion, like especially with my voice. Mm. Like I'm not forcing anything. Like that's one thing is I used never be able to walk away from a song unfinished. So I'd stay up for days and days at a time working on one song. So I'm able to recognize when I'm inspired and when I'm not, and work during times I'm inspired, you know? And just like my voice is a lot more of an instrument now. I'm able to use it in a lot more different ways. And I just sound more awake.
What's your philosophy as a producer? Like who are the people you admire when as far as that?
Well, like it's everyone from like, you know, like a Rick Rubin idea of like just overseeing things, which I really love, and just like trying to get people to capture that emotion and to dig deep into what they're writing about and just like giving chase. And then also like I try and do as many things as possible. That's kind of my whole thing with producing is I try and come in sometimes as somebody who doesn't even put my hands to a set of keys and like just like direct the situation to like sitting down and making a whole beat from scratch on Ableton. It's like pick one thing because I'm still figuring it out. Like to me, I haven't, you know, like picked a single lane, and I don't know if I ever will.
Mm. You're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now, and that was me, Brian Hyatt, with Mac Miller, who passed away recently. Brendan, his final album, unfortunately, Swimming, is probably his best. It came out in August.
Mm-hmm. Came out about a month ago,
and it continued really what was going on in Divine Feminine, though emotionally to me it's darker for sure.
It's much darker. Yeah. Deals a lot different stuff. I think it is a much tighter album than Divine Feminine. If Divine Feminine took him on this jazz inflected live instrumentation sound, this was really another iteration on that. Like he tightened all the screws. It feels where Divine Feminine kind of meanders a lot and like is confident in that. He's writing like really tight songs that like feel more honed in and like more urgent.
The first track, Come Back to Earth, really speaks a lot to where his head's at. The first line is, my regrets look like texts I shouldn't send. And then there's this repeated thing that is pretty haunting. I'll do anything for a way out of my head. But let's hear that song if we can. Alternate reality. I was drowning, but now I'm swimming. Too stressed for wildness to relieve. I mean, he told me that he was determined to get better every single time. And also that with Divine Feminine, I meant to say this earlier, Brendan, you were saying that, you know, you and other people, everyone was surprised by the album. He said he was surprised that people were surprised, you know, because for him, I think he knew he had these capabilities, but it's always sad when someone who's 26 years old dies. It's sad when someone who's a talented artist dies. It compounds it when you realize this guy was a guy who really was getting better by leaps and bounds, you know?
Yeah. I've been talking about his career in like these three acts. Like he does the party stuff, then he gets into this like avant-garde rap, and then he starts to get into these like jazzy, more songwriting based albums. And there's no indication that like the third act was the final act. Like I think I was really excited to hear and always thought I would hear, like the fourth and fifth and sixth act of Mac Miller. And the exciting thing about like watching him develop was you had no idea what those were going to sound like. Like he just kept getting better and more interesting. I think that of his catalog, he didn't have like a clear masterpiece, although Swimming gets the closest. But there wasn't a whole lot of doubt among the people who were paying attention that like he would have one under his belt.
Right.
In the next couple of years.
That's what's so frustrating. It was clearly what, like, all these albums have their flaws and stuff. And it's like, you know, and he was so young, it's clear that he was probably working up to something, you know.
Yeah.
But
there was a real, like, greatness was still on the horizon for him. And, like, but there wasn't that much doubt that he would reach it.
Yeah. We're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about a story that Brittany wrote for Rolling Stone. Called Ariana Grande, Mac Miller, and the Demonization of Women in Toxic Relationships. And to give a little backstory, when Mac died apparently of an overdose, there was a crazy thing online where people sort of literally blamed Ariana for breaking up with him and, you know, purportedly breaking his heart and leading to this and not supporting him purportedly through his addiction. But that was actually picking up on, as you wrote, this previous thing where some random dude tweeted Mac Miller getting a DUI after Ariana Grande dumped him for another dude after he poured his heart out on a 10-song album to her called The Divine Feminine is just the most heartbreaking thing happening in Hollywood. And she basically said, like, how dare you say that someone should stay in a toxic relationship because he wrote an album about them? Like, it's just, like, why do women have to be the caretakers? Why are they responsible for the well-being of someone with a substance problem?
Right. I mean, the thing with Ariana and Mac to note is that they were very under the radar for the 2 years that they actively dated. Like, they weren't a tabloidy couple at all. There weren't a lot of stories about them. They just kind of went on about their lives. And then this year, especially, there was this really crazy timeline of they had their breakup, and then Ariana started dating Pete Davidson, and that because of the relationship and just how wacky people thought it was, and then later the engagement, it was followed a lot, and then Mac got into a car accident, a DUI, and got a DUI from that. So there was a lot of things happening at once, and with that, there was a lot of people coming out and blaming Ariana in the same way. I mean, not to the extreme of what happened after Mac's death, but after the DUI, her comments on Instagram and Twitter and across, you know, just these social media platforms were very much, you did this to him, in the same way that it would come back later. So she did end up responding to just one of the fans. I don't think she even responded to a lot of other tweets, but that was kind of the most cogent of the tweets that were sent to her. And she did really lay out, like you said, this idea that they were in a toxic relationship, and a lot of friends of Mac's have spoken out and in defense of her and said that a lot of their relationship was her trying to help him stay sober and be a support system for him. And it's clear that because she couldn't be the caretaker or mother in this way that we expect women, especially in these really toxic dynamics of dealing with someone who is addicted in a relationship, she has been sort of the blame for this.
You did connect it to the you know, the purported Yoko effect and, mm-hmm. and the idea it's like that Courtney Love got blamed for Kurt Cobain's death to the point where people were doing conspiracy theories that somehow she, you know, perpetrated it, which is so preposterous. So there is this weird temptation to cast things that way. It's a cultural sickness, really.
Yeah, especially for famous relationships and when there is this very like tabloidy element and we have a more outspoken woman in the relationship and there are these kind of demons that the male figure is dealing with. I think it's easier for, especially really fervent fandoms, the ones like that Mac Miller has or that Nirvana has, like that it's easier to blame the woman who's closest to them for kind of whatever downfall we deem or whatever happens to them.
I mean, how do you see it related to the Yoko Ono thing? Is just that if something goes wrong, people just want to blame the woman.
Yeah.
That basically is,
yeah,
what,
yeah.
That?
I think, I mean, Yoko's obviously a very different situation, and that's just with the Beatles breakup. I mean, no one's blaming her for Lennon's death, but I think that sort of dynamic of blaming the woman for something that happens that the fans can't control, that's been a recurring theme in pop music, especially for really famous couples.
Yeah, you know, and she went on into a very another super high profile relationship, mm-hmm. that went into an engagement. It's so ridiculous, really. And it's like a sickness of social media that people would actually post that kind of stuff. And not for one second would he want that, clearly. Ariana Grande, you know, she's now clouded by many tragedies. She's got such a fraught narrative, mm-hmm. now as a pop star. It's wild.
Yeah. I mean, just from the Manchester attacks last year and things like that. It's been a really, really just wild year for her to deal with, especially as a 25-year-old pop star. And I think there it was very clear with her and Mac that there was no like love lost between them and their friendship. They had known each other for 5 years and had worked together so much. And I think in a lot of their interviews and posts about each other after the breakup, that the hard feelings weren't as much there.
Brennan, how do you think that people are in the end, because people are going to have to now kind of take the sum of his career and sort of address it as a whole and look back at him. How are we going to remember him?
I mean, fondly.
Yeah.
I think that, like I was talking about, there's this masterpiece that never came, but he still has a really, really large body of work that like spans a bunch of different stuff. And even just now, like going running through it today, seeing the artistic growth, and then like also he has some just like hands down classic songs that I don't think he is going to be forgotten.
For sure. So this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt, and I was in the studio with Brendan Klinkenberg and Brittany Spanos, and we celebrated the life of music with Mac Miller. We'll be back next week here on Sirius XM's Volume, channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast. Download us as a podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. I read them all. But as always, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.